Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to a new episode of your favorite podcast. I am one of your hosts, Marcus in the Darkest, and with me is my buddy,
Ray Koob, and this week it is our 13th episode.
Lucky 13.
Okay, 13. You say lucky, I say unlucky. How ironic that episode 13 is a further exploration of a previous family tree. We covered the Yardbirds family tree. And this week, descended from the Yardbirds, of course, Led Zeppelin.
We're going to hit you with the hammer of the gods today.
That's it. We're dropping the lead on you.
Boom.
And, you know, we talked a lot about the Yardbirds in the episode of the family tree of the Yardbirds. We can kind of cut to the chase a little bit. At the end, after Beck had left, it was Jimmy Page with the Yardbirds. It just didn't fly. We've talked in the Yardbirds family episode about how Keith Relf was looking to do something different and ended up starting the band Renaissance. And that left the Yardbirds really with Chris Drazia and Jimmy Page. And there were dates. There were dates that had to be fulfilled for the Yardbirds that had been booked. It's one of those situations where you've already got the deposit and you don't want to give the money back, I think.
Yeah.
So they have to form a new Yardbirds to fulfill the contract. They talked to Terry Reid, who was pretty well known in the scene back then, and he turned it down, but he recommended this kid, Robert Plant, from Birmingham. And as we know, with Plant comes Bonham.
Yep. Those two were almost inseparable back in those days.
So that was the start of Led Zeppelin as the new Yardbirds. And they did the Scandinavian tour, and I think there were a couple of UK shows that were billed as the last Yardbird shows ever. Because Chris Drazia claimed that he would retain the name of the rights to the Yardbirds. He kind of forced them to make a change that Jimmy Page and the band's manager, Peter Grant, had already been discussing, and that was giving the band a new name.
Which they had to do at that point. They had to. It was totally a different lineup. You had to. It was going to be a different sound.
And it was a different sound. Maybe when they were in Scandinavia, they found, hey, well, this is our sound, and it's definitely different from the Yardbirds.
Mm-hmm.
So somewhere in there, Keith Moon made the now famous comment when it was described to him what they were going to do. The saying here in the States is it'll go over like a lead balloon. Which means it's not going to go very far,
yeah.
Right? And he said, that should go over like a Led Zeppelin. And that's the legend on how they got their name. And
yeah.
So eventually Page and Grant decided we're going to change the name. And what the fuck? Keith said it. So Mooney must know something. Let's go with Led Zeppelin.
That's just crazy that things like that. Like, those are Spinal Tap moments in real life.
You know, a lot of Spinal Tap is based in truth.
I know, that's...
that much has got to be clear by now if you've seen the movie more than twice.
Yep.
But,
Arnie Pufkin.
Kick me in the ass. No, kick me right in the ass.
Yep.
That's kind of like what they all came out of. And once they knew they were going to call themselves Led Zeppelin, they had to get to the studio. Led Zeppelin was a touring beast. Born of the Yardbirds, they were a touring beast. They got in the studio, and Page having... I would see being the maestro of this whole thing, took the production reins and really put his stamp on it. You don't have to go through all the songs on Led Zeppelin 1 to realize that these were almost all classics. But as we were discussing earlier, it wasn't an instant classic acceptance scenario, was it?
No, they were not. They were actually panned quite a bit by critics. Lisa Robinson said that other journalists were calling them a cheesy heavy metal band. One critic had written that Robert Plant only sings notes that dogs can hear. I mean, these were some harsh things.
Harsh. First things first.
Yeah.
Let's redirect that first comment. How could they be cheesy heavy metal when heavy metal was just being invented? Okay. Rolling Stone had some very unkind things to say, and would continue to not be fans of Led Zeppelin for many years. John Mendelsohn wrote of Led Zeppelin 1, "The popular formula in England in this, the aftermath era of such successful British bluesmen as Cream and John Mayall," by the way, Cream wasn't a bluesman, it was Eric Clapton, "seems to be, add an excellent guitarist who since leaving the Yardbirds and or Mayall has become a minor musical deity, a competent rhythm section, and pretty soul belter who can do a good spade imitation." What the fuck is that all about?
No racism there.
Rolling Stone magazine. "The latest of the British blues groups, so conceived, offers little that its twin, the Jeff Beck Group, didn't say well or better 3 months ago, and the excesses of the Beck Group's Truth album, most notably its self-indulgence and restrictedness, are fully evidenced on Led Zeppelin's debut album." I would say that that would characterize the tone of most critics. A lot of critics, not all.
Mm-hmm.
I'm betting if Lester Bangs was writing like in his notebook at school, he was writing Led Zeppelin rules. But anyway,
yeah, but you know who Lester Bangs panned the crap out of their debut record?
Who?
Black Sabbath.
Hmm.
He actually panned it, but
But Rolling Stone never really liked Led Zeppelin. But
they
here's
never
the thing.
Have.
Here's the thing: the fans loved Led Zeppelin.
Oh,
they
yeah.
bought the record. They went to the shows. I know people who saw them on their first U.S. tour before the record was out. The record was made. They came over. They played. Hardly anybody knew who they were. They would open. They would play at small places.
Were they good live back then?
The tapes I've heard sound pretty good. I don't know for sure because I wasn't there, but I know some people we could ask sometime.
We should.
Maybe have them on the show.
Absolutely.
Okay. So they go out and they're touring. And they're playing these songs, and they're playing still some of the stuff from the Yardbirds repertoire, but they're really defining themselves. And, of course, Page starts doing the whole bow thing on Dazed and Confused, and they're starting to create their own flair. Along the way in the touring, some infamous incidents. Most notably, they were known for trashing hotel rooms and all the rock star things. They kind of started that, I think. They're one of the people who started it. But there also is the Mud Shark incident in Seattle.
Or a Red Snapper, depending on who you talk
depending
to. There's about five or six different stories.
And who was the plier of said fish is also up to debate. There's a lot of different things that it wasn't even a band member, that it was Richard Cole. I don't know. I wasn't there. But all this debauchery was going on. Plant later basically said that, hey, me and John were 19-year-old kids. We were kids, you know, out having a crazy time. And so nobody was really putting any restrictions on them because they were out there on the road. And they had different girlfriends in every port.
Oh, yeah.
And there was a wild scene after every show.
They never took their wives with them to the United
when
States.
When they had them, no, they did not.
The decadence of Led Zeppelin in the U.S. was legendary. They actually viewed the United States as a candy store.
Yeah,
That's the way Led Zeppelin came over here with that attitude. And he was very competitive with the Rolling Stones, too. He was like... Robert Plant.
Okay.
Like, he always wanted to be better than Mick. And, like, he always felt competitive with Mick because of how they took their sound and evolved it into that dirty, beautiful, perfect sound that became what we know is who the Rolling Stones really are.
Well, Zeppelin was on a path to doing just that. And when they were on the road, when they had kind of ended the cycle of the first album, they had started to gain fans through FM radio. They had a large legion of record buyers who were supporting them. And the crowd started to get pretty big, too. Mm. And
73, they were doing arenas.
Well, yeah,
and selling
but before,
them out.
But before you get there, they're touring doing, while they're touring in each city, then they had a song they thought was ready. They would go into a local studio and lay down tracks. So parts, if you look at the locations for where the songs were recorded for Led Zeppelin II, it's all over the place.
Oh, yeah.
Including Juggies in a studio in New York. There's all kinds of different credits for that kind of stuff. So they're doing that, and they're carting the masters with them. Those tapes weighed. So if you had two or three masters for each song, you know, different takes and things, you had all kinds of tape traveling with you. So they finish Led Zeppelin II, and they go on tour, and it's just exhausting. They have been touring since the minute they became a band. Yeah. They've made two records in like a year and a half.
Mm-hmm. Did you know that Peter Grant had signed them to Atlantic for like $200,000 without any execs ever hearing them play live?
He
did some crazy stuff that was unheard of.
Oh, legendary. As a manager?
They changed rock and roll. They made it the big arena business that we started seeing in a lot of ways.
Remember in episode 2 when we were talking about the Beatles changing everything from the way songs were selected?
Mm-hmm.
In that atmosphere, Led Zeppelin took it to a whole nother level.
Oh, yeah. A heavier level.
Everything was under their own control, record company guys. From the beginning, like you just said, they signed for whatever they signed for, sight unseen, because they knew it was going to be good.
Yep.
And some of the credit there, give a lot of credit to Ahmet's team, because those guys in Atlantic knew
what they were doing.
What they were doing.
Yeah, they really were good at talent scouts and doing the formula.
And by this point, at the end of the release of Led Zeppelin II, having been on the road, they just stayed on the road back and forth. They would just go back and forth. And the tours in the United States got bigger and crazier. And then they started playing the arena, sure. But then they set an all-time record. I think it was in Atlanta. No one had ever had a crowd that big at a rock concert in America at that point. And it wasn't like 100,000 people like we'd see later at JFK and stuff. Yeah. But then they're exhausted.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know about you. When you need to recharge, I know you listen to Nina Simone.
Yeah.
Okay, but when do you do? If you're in a band that's been all over the world, what do you do? I don't even know how they came up with this.
What'd they do?
There's a little cottage in Wales. A little place called Bron Yr.
Ah, the Bron Yr song.
No running water. I may have had water. Might have even had, but I think they had outdoor plumbing, no plumbing, no electricity. And there's people who live there now who get visitors all the time, and they say it's okay to come up and visit, but don't just kind of like skulk around. It freaks them out. But so they went there, and they just kind of hung out, and they did camp writing by the campfire. And here's an intersection with a friend of theirs. One of the guys, if you go look at the old Grey Whistle Test videos of this time, there's a video of, it's film, I guess, of Paige and Roy Harper, as in hats off to Roy Harper.
Oh, my God.
Walking through a field, and Paige is just playing, strumming, and him and Harper are just kind of hanging out. So he was there with them for some of the time at Bron Yr, so I don't know about that much. And then they come out with Led Zeppelin III.
Their sound changed quite a bit between 2 and 3. Well, the evolution was very interesting.
Look at the two sides of Led Zeppelin III. One side is considered the soft side. And that's where you get songs like That's the Way and some of the softer stuff. And then the other side's like Since I've Been Loving You and the rock and stuff out on the tiles.
Immigrant.
So it was really like they were exploring. You look at the first two records, and it was solidly ballsy blues rock.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there wasn't a whole lot of experimenting.
No.
And this brought in some textures, which laid into or played into their heritage as British musicians, and a little bit of Wales thrown in there, the Welsh folk element, and you get Led Zeppelin III. There was critical backlash on that one too, because they didn't stay true to what their mission seems to be. Kind of critique of them. And the original Led Zeppelin III album had the cymbals on the outside, and it had the wheel. And the wheel would spin so that the cover would actually change.
Yeah.
It was one of the first covers that ever said, you know, hey, we can, it can be a different cover if you just spin the wheel, right?
Yep.
And I think they took shit for that because they, people said it was you know, like a gimmicky.
Excessive and gimmicky, yes.
Yeah. So what do? In response to being called gimmicky and they're trying too hard, they come back with what's arguably their greatest album, Led Zeppelin IV.
Yeah.
No name of the band on the cover. Nothing,
so-so.
No title, no nut, just the pictures, right? Nothing. Grant was adamant that he didn't even want a sticker that said this is Led Zeppelin's fourth record. They wanted the word to get out that it was coming. This is what it is. You would know what it was. You'd see the ads, whatever the motivator was, and you would go get it. But the record company was really nervous. This is a band that wouldn't let them put out singles.
Yeah. The band didn't release singles.
No.
And they didn't play free shows or any of that.
No, nobody, there wasn't as much of that going on.
They didn't stop by radio stations and do like TV performances either.
No, you don't see a lot or hear a lot
of
that stuff.
Yeah, there really wasn't any of that.
It was part of the mystique, I think, that they built up, and a lot of it was around mysticism and Crowley and all that stuff. So there they are. They're four records in, and it's, what's it, like four records in like 30, not even 3 years,
yeah.
You know, it's like less than 3 years, and they've had this whirlwind around them. What will they do next? The answer after four records was Houses of the Holy.
A lot of people claim that Houses of the Holy or Physical Graffiti are the quintessential Led Zeppelin records, but you said probably their greatest record four.
Just because ounce for ounce, pound for pound.
It's a monster.
It's packed with muscle and energy and the flip side on things
it's
like Going to California.
Too.
Yeah.
It's one of the sexiest rock and roll albums ever recorded. True.
Highly recommended for sexual activity.
Very much. I mean, think about the love that Damone gave it in Fast Times at Ridgemont High. That alone tells you the importance of
Amen.
Side One Led Zeppelin IV. Oh, yeah.
And that's where we pick it up on the Imbalanced History of Rock and Roll when we come back after this special 10th anniversary celebration of our friends at Crooked Eye Brewery. Sitting here at the backstage door at the Crooked Eye 10th anniversary celebration for backer people. Too many men wearing kilts, even for Crooked Eye nights. There's always somebody in a kilt. And you hear the guys are getting themselves set up, the Crooked Eye band getting ready to take the stage in a few minutes. Here at Crooked Eye with Dennis from the Crooked Eye band. What's this place mean to you as a musician and as a guy?
Well, I've been searching my whole life for a place like this. I've played many places, near and far, large and small. And this is my absolute favorite place to play. There is something magical here. And you feel it. You've been here a number of times. It's this strange vibe between the people that have a high music quotient and a band that just wants to play. And for anybody that wants to listen, and the reciprocation that occurs between the two and the way that can...
It's a symbiosis, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, and it's a wonderful thing. Robert Fripp describes it very well as it lifts the craft off the ground. It puts the wind into the sail.
When we all started hanging out here, did you ever think we'd be doing 10 years?
I thought I'd be playing here until I couldn't play anymore.
The man who lays down the nasty beats, Mr. Jeff Moran on bass, Crooked Eye Band. 10 years we're marking tonight.
10 years.
First off, did you think we'd be here 10 years later?
No, this is so incredible that this has turned into, A, it's such a great brewery, and B, such a great music venue that they allow us to come in here and play.
So what's Crooked Eye mean to you, man?
Family. It's definitely a family atmosphere. And the families that own it and the families that come here and the people that hang here are just... They're like brothers and sisters and mothers and dads and everything. Unbelievable. I remember walking up, I ordered a brown ale. The Top Hat brown ale was the first beer I had. It was pretty good. It was like they had, I think, four beers on tap. And it was this little wooden shelf that you had to come up there. And it was crazy. I'm like, oh, and now it's what it is today. It's just unbelievable.
the master brewer, Jeff Mulheron. How you doing, man?
I'm doing well. This is kind of surreal. Can't believe it's been 10 years.
What's been the best part of this whole thing for you as a person and as a brewer?
Probably being my own boss, being able to be creative, and doing a job that I absolutely love.
That's Jeff. And here are the brothers-in-law, Paul and Paul, who, along with Jeff, you started in whose kitchen was it?
It was in Jeff's kitchen, and we moved it into my garage.
Yeah, we've been doing it for a while. Then we decided to give this a shot.
Now, a lot of people have been posting the pictures of then and now of this space. We're standing in the brew room right now. Marcus and I talk about this all the time. But the pictures on your Facebook really show how far you've come from the plank bar at the beginning, at the front, just it's at the front here. Now the whole building is pretty much you guys, and it's a blossoming brewery and quite an affair at 10.
Thanks for the advertising you do for us. Helps a lot.
Yep. One hand washing the other. Thanks for your support.
Oh, that's guys. It. Thanks for your support through the years, and many more to come.
Quite a party, guys. The Crooked Eye Band is taking the stage. But what do they mean to you?
Those guys are like family. They've been with us since almost the very beginning, and it just keeps growing and growing and growing.
Yeah, they're amazing musicians, and they're even better people.
It's the Brewery Brain Trust. The Mulherons here with us at the 10th anniversary celebration of Crooked Eye. 10 years!
10 years!
Happy
birthday!
1070!
Back to Led Zeppelin, Descended from the Gods, a special re-release.
But Houses of the Holy was different. It started to have some different textures, but not like acoustic versus electric. You had the Crunge, which is their half tribute to James Brown. You had some songs that were conceived differently. The Rain Song and No Quarter. And it wasn't just soft songs. It was start like a No Quarter starts soft and builds. Rain Song.
The arrangements are brilliant on that album.
And a lot of that, you hear a lot of that, is John Paul Jones handed things, you know.
And Bonham, too.
Well, you know, his drumming, I've always said that it's one of the most distinguishing qualities of Led Zeppelin. Because you listen to all those tracks on Led Zeppelin 4 recorded in that stairwell at Headley Grange.
Mm-hmm.
It's otherworldly.
Mm-hmm.
They take more shit for it now than they did then, but the cover of Houses of the Holy stirred up some issues. Not because the religious or censorship people were thinking of the exploitation of children. It's just that it was so different. It was certainly different from the covers they'd put out. Today, you would just take a few of those kids, pose them on rocks, do them in a couple different other positions, capture them all, and spread them out over the hill. And there was a day when they were working when it was rainy, and the makeup began to run, so they really were stretched to make the concept work. But I think that was hypnosis. They always managed to pull it all together in the
kidding.
And then clean it up in the post, you know.
The magic.
But the music on that record got them some bad reviews, even from some of the writers who had been writing brilliant things about them for the past few previous years.
What didn't people like about Houses of the Holy? How can you not like it? It's a fantastic album, and it's so easy. Seriously, throw it on vinyl, throw it on a turntable, and listen to it on cans in the dark, and you'll see how good it is.
It's the first Zeppelin record that I went and bought the day it came out, and I went home and I listened to it about 4 or 5 times. And at the end of that, I knew it was brilliant, but there were things that didn't ring true to what I'd grown accustomed to hearing from Led Zeppelin. Let's just say that. But again, they go on tour. It's just making money hand over fist, playing big places. Next on the hit parade came the sessions that would lead to what became Physical Graffiti. It was a difficult time for Led Zeppelin. Okay, they just had 5 successful albums, toured all over the world. They'd set up shop at Headley Grange. If you find a place that you really like to record in, you should use it.
Mm-hmm.
Jonesy shows up and basically says that he's quitting. He's thinking of quitting. He's done.
Was he just tired from the life?
I think, the
craziness, the touring and the recording.
And you got to realize he came, like Page did, from the relatively normal lifestyle of being a studio musician where you're always, you know, hustling from home to the studio and back to the bar and off to the house and back to the studio.
Mm-hmm.
And here he was traveling all over the world. And he made a comment, which has become part of Zeppelin lore, but it was kind of meant as a half joke that, you know, they were asking him, so what are you going to do if you're just going to take off? What are you going to do? What are you going to quit? What are you going to do? And he says, oh, there's an ad for an organist at Winchester Cathedral. I think I'll apply. Maybe they'll have me. And then it morphed into a story. He was going to be the choir master at Winchester Cathedral.
Wow.
But it was basically that he was tired. Grant told him, take a year off. If that's what you need to do, clear your head and see where we're at. And they could do that, I think, you know, at that point. So that was like November 73, and they had written these songs that later became known as the Big Eight. So they were going into Headley Grange to lay down these songs and figure out what was going to be the next album. Well, they had just signed Bad Company, this new group, to Swan Song, their label. And basically they rushed them in to Headley Grange to set up and recorded that amazing first Bad Company record while Zeppelin was sorting itself out.
Whoa.
When they resumed in 74, they got down to it and recorded those songs, but they found out it was too much for one album and not enough for two. You know, you had long songs like In My Time of Dying, Kashmir is a longer song, so things like that. So they went back and they looked at what were the outtakes. Mostly from House of the Holy and from Zeppelin IV, but some other stuff too. They put it all together, they figured it out, and again with a very unique album cover concept.
Oh yeah.
They came up with Physical Graffiti, and that fueled the next round of touring and fun and games.
The legendary 1975 touring?
Oh yes. Think about it. Zeppelin and the Stones were destroying America in 1975. Every night one of them was setting it up and setting it off.
Oh, my God.
Throughout that most of that year.
Oh, my God. I can't even imagine.
Then the challenges that faced Led Zeppelin really started to kick in. And the fans and some of the press started talking about the deal with the devil and all that kind of
horseshit. Yeah, and the weird shit started happening.
Well, the first one was bad. It really was. Robert Plant and his wife were in a serious car accident in Greece on the island of Rhodes. Plant got banged up pretty bad. She was badly injured, too. They say it took a blood transfusion to save her life.
Yeah, that's what they said.
And Plant couldn't walk for a while. In fact, he was still in the wheelchair when they went to Musicland Studios to make the record that would become Presence. And did a lot of his singing from in those sessions from the wheelchair.
Wow.
It just blew my mind. That's how bad it was. So they go through that. We talked about Presence a little bit. Nobody, including the Rolling Stones, could believe it, that when they showed up to make what would become Black and Blue, that not only was Zeppelin done, that Page had left the studio, all it was all cleaned up and ready for them and everything, but it involved marathon overdub sessions that were legendary, even though the magic was just pouring out of them. And some of those tracks are some of the fans' most favorite.
I've read through multiple sources that Jimmy Page didn't sleep very often, and you were lucky if you got him on 5 or 6 hours of sleep. He was amazing. Like,
wow.
Just an amazing
ever?
Person. Yeah, Lisa Robinson in her book talked a little bit about how Page never slept. And I'm sure some of it had to do with the drug use, but a lot of it had to do with his brain and his creativity.
Well, by 1977, they had put out Presence. They were on the road. They were on top of the world. Not the momentary lapse of reason from John Paul Jones aside. They had the accident, and they recovered from that. And then while Robert was on tour with the band in 1977, his son Carrick was a pretty small guy. I think he was 5. Died from a stomach virus in the middle of the tour, and that put the brakes on the tour.
Yeah.
You know, they weren't going to be able to continue.
Nope.
And that's what we were talking about. He wrote All My Love for his son.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people sing it to a lover, But that's what he was singing about, was the love of the son, Derek. And I've seen him interviewed talking about it. And even now, in his later years, talking about his son, I heard him once, he'd be 45 now, you know, and it's like you can see it through the eyes of a parent. And as a parent, I know you know exactly what I'm talking about.
Oh, yeah.
They're so precious to us. And I think part of him was broken from that. More than the injuries, than from the accident.
Oh, absolutely. That's his son.
He just, you know, and I've seen the way friends, and I see the way that other famous people deal when they've lost a child. And, but in the interviews I've seen with Plant where he talks about it, you know, as a dad, your heart just goes out to him even now for the loss so long ago. It's a long time ago.
Oh, my God.
But they do In Through the Outdoor. Right?
It's a great album, too, by the way.
Yeah, it showed another aspect of their musicality. And the cover was cool, too, because there were different ones.
Yeah. You had the paper bag.
And you didn't know which one you were going to get. Yeah. And there was the same scene shot from all different angles. Nobody had done that before.
I remember that was one I got for my bar mitzvah when it came out. And to me, that album holds dearest to my heart because of the fact that my brother gave it to me when I was like 12, 13 years old, for right before my bar mitzvah.
Cool.
So, and
those things never leave you.
And In the Evening is still one of my favorite songs. And
now, I don't know if it was because of all the tumultuous things that have happened and the challenges they'd faced, but they changed it up, and they, instead of doing it either at Headley Grange or in LA or studios in London and New York, they went to Polar Studios in Stockholm.
I think it was a big change because of all the pain and the suffering.
Yeah, I think they just needed to change it up.
Yep.
And it got mixed reactions again. After Physical Graffiti and Presence, they started to win even some of the critics over, but they got panned a little bit on it. And it was because it was experimental, and it also showed more of John Paul Jones's hand in things with the with the arrangements, his ability to arrange strings, his keyboard work was more highlighted. They felt like they were able to do just about anything and get away with it. Like, we're going to try this. We're going to go to a different studio. We're going to make this different kind of record, and we're going to see how it goes. We're still Led fucking Zeppelin, you know.
And it's still rock and roll.
So they go and they play at Nebworth.
Yeah.
Time to get your parkas on. Start up your scooters.
Legendary shows. They play two nights. What they say, over 100,000 people each night. They do a little low-key European tour. We're getting back to the stripped-down Led Zeppelin sound, even while having this orchestrally enhanced record, right?
Yeah.
But in the middle of this, all this stretch, Bonham begins to show signs of something not being right.
The alcoholism taking its toll.
Collapsed on stage. Alcohol alone can take its toll. And he was taking something else. And it combined with the alcohol got to be too much.
Did he have chronic pain or anything like that? Because he hit the drums so fucking hard,
right?
Man, that dude banged the shit out of the
drums. I don't know what it is. I know that alcoholism, especially severe, can be debilitating the way any drug habit can.
Oh, easily.
It's a drug. One of their guys picked him up on September 24th. To go to rehearsals. On the way, he stopped for breakfast, which was 4 quadruple vodkas.
That's like 16 shots.
16 shots of vodka with a ham roll sandwich. And continued to drink after arriving at the studio. And the band went back to Page's house. Bonham was asleep in the chair. And when they found him the next day, he had died of asphyxiation. There's only so much alcohol you can drink until you're going to vomit, killing yourself in your sleep. If you're that drunk that you can't roll over or stop it, you can die. It happened to Hendrix.
Mm-hmm.
His was a combination of alcohol and barbiturates.
Yeah, barbs.
They said he was on something, Motival, which I don't even know what the hell that would be in today's medical terms, but it was because of his anxiety. It's hard to believe that a guy like Bonzo could have anxiety.
I know.
That's it.
They couldn't replace him.
No.
He was the second most talented guy in the band.
There have been multiple attempts to talk Plant into it. I'm not saying that Jimmy's been hard on him, but other people, the money people...
Yeah. They people did audition drummers, according to Lisa Robinson.
There was nothing that, yeah, and there was, they, I think Plant, you know, they were mates from the beginning of the whole thing before they met Page and Jones. It was done for him. Took him a while to do a solo career, which obviously sounded, if you remember, very different than Led Zeppelin.
Oh, completely different. He did that on purpose.
There was a Honey Drippers thing, and there was, Jimmy did the Firm and did soundtracks and did a lot of
did
session work.
Did the stuff
work.
With the Black Crows,
yeah,
which was really
nice. Yeah, and then he
did
the tour with the Black Crows and all that. And all through it, there was always the conversation. It was similar to a conversation that was had all through the 70s about a Beatles reunion. It never felt right. There was that project we talked about. There was the XYZ, the X-Yes and Zeppelin guys that were going to do a project that never got finished. But Plant's whole thing was when he started doing it was it's too soon. It was like a year and a half, 2 years after, and it was still too soon for him.
His grieving for his very dear mate took a long time, you know.
When they finally agreed to do something at the O2 Arena, it was to honor Ahmet, who was their mentor. It was obviously captured very well. It was a big selling DVD and album. But in the last dozen years, at least a half dozen attempts have been made to try to coax them into something. Limited tour for big, big, big money.
Yeah.
It's not about the money.
They don't
They've
care.
Got it.
They have it all.
They've got it. Page is happy with his life. Plant likes playing with the Sensational Space Shifters.
Yeah.
JPJ does what JPJ does.
He wants to do like them Crooked Vultures and stuff like that.
Great record. I have it. I was
I
just listening
love
to
it
the other day. The one person that ends up out there on a regular basis promoting the Zeppelin legacy is son of Bonzo, Jason Bonham, really.
Yeah, but he recently had to sign over the legalities to the Led Zeppelin Experience back to the Led Zeppelin company. So
yes,
that means there's something going down. We just don't know what it is.
Conjecture at the time was indicating that people thought there was going to be some kind of a Zeppelin app or something like that that would be the Led, that they would need the name Led Zeppelin Experience for.
Mm-hmm.
And that made sense to me. And he understood without even a moment's hesitation or a fight or anything, because he knows that this is his family.
Mm-hmm.
And that if dad were alive, he'd kick his ass for saying no.
Absolutely.
But so they did it the right way, and he continues to do the Led Zeppelin, evening, as he calls it, and it goes out there, and he does his father proud, I'm sure, every day.
Yes, he does.
And I just wish that, they could have stopped Bonzo, because this band could be still doing
could you imagine
what they were meant to do. If
could
you think
imagine?
About it, if you think about it, when you boil it all down, they're one of the most enduring bands of all time, retaining their stature as the greatest of their era, even being stopped in mid-flight. It's amazing.
Yeah. They stopped abruptly at the top.
Yeah. Unexpectedly.
Yeah,
abruptly.
Completely unexpectedly abruptly at the top.
All right, my friend, time to wrap it up, pack up the plantation, and head back to where we both go when we're not doing this podcast thingy. It is a production of Dark Doc Media. I'm the Doc, Ray Koob.
I'm Marcus in the Darkest.
And we'll catch you next time on the Imbalanced History
of Rock and Roll.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.